up to now, there have been more than 12 cases decided in favor of the workers. With these sentences, they are trying to get them executed in the United States.
A United States court has finally admitted a lawsuit by 25 banana workers against Royal Dutch Shell Group, Occidental Chemical Corporation, and Dow Chemical for producing the DBCP pesticide, Standard Fruit Company or Chiquita Brands International, Dole Food Company, and Del Monte Foods. Bayaro Isava says that if the workers exhaust all the judicial means without getting justice, it's possible that their case could be presented to an international legal body. For Free Speech Radio News from Chinandega, Nicaragua, this is Nan McCurdy.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.
Okay, hello. This is Ray Anderson, and you are tuned to WUSB Stony Brook, which is 90.1 on the FM dial. And I know this because I am also tuned to USB Stony Brook on a regular basis. So enjoy yourself.
It's a lot later than you think. It's actually a minute early. It's 5:59, but what the hell. We're going to start with the show anyway. Oh, we have a new CD player, and apparently it needs to know who's boss. Listen, when I press the button, it doesn't mean play it for a second. It means play the whole damn thing. All right, I've chastised you on the air now, so you're officially broken in. We'll make like it didn't happen. It's time for Off the Wall. You know, I don't understand this. I really don't. I've had many CD players throughout my life, and, you know, when you press the buttons, they generally do something. Here, maybe it's the room. Maybe the room is cursed when you press buttons in the... Because the button is in the same place as the button on the last CD player that has since been sent to hell. All right, listen. We're just going to try this one more time. Now it's after 6 o'clock. Time for Off the Wall. And now I'm going to press the button. It started in the middle. You know what? I'm going to cut my losses. Better yet, you know what? I'm just going to kick this CD player out of here and move to a different CD player. How's that? Different theme, too.
By the telescope, a faint fantasy.
This is Britain.
Love is sister and brother.
Life, love, and unity. Life, love, and unity. Life, love, and unity.
And good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you for the this week, the next 50 minutes, or 47 minutes at this point, because we have a lacrosse game coming up starting at 6:50. And boy, is that ever exciting. I mean that. I really do. Lacrosse is an exciting sport because you don't know if you're going to live through it. if you're playing, that is. And I guess for some spectators, too, if the ball goes astray, or the mallet, or whatever they call the thing that they carry. Anyway, that's taking place here at Stony Brook against Hofstra. The Hofstra, you know, okay, first of all, I've made fun of the Stony Brook Seahawk name, because there's no such animal as a Seahawk, at least none that's been discovered as of yet. So they make up this crazy crazy image of some animal that's apparently in the water, but no, not a Seahawk, I'm sorry, of course it's a Sea Wolf. Yeah, that's what it is. The Stony Brook Sea Wolves, that's what every team here is known as. But that doesn't match what's coming to visit us today, the Hofstra University Pride. Yes, the Pride of Hofstra University. If that's not the silliest name I've ever heard, I don't know. It just conjures up all kinds of images. Yeah, so the Pride will be here, but they won't be so proud once the Seawolves have at them. So consider that a challenge, if you will. And we'll be broadcasting the game live at 6:50. And you know what else? The Hofstra station at 88.7 is also going to be broadcasting the game live at the same time. So that's kind of a contest, too.
You personally are responsible as an individual. And so am I. We are all responsible.
And, of course, speaking of responsibility leads us back to world news, which we always focus on this program. And, you know, I don't want to spend the next 10 years talking about Iraq. I really don't. But it sure seems like that's what's being handed to me here, because every week it just gets more and more absurd and ridiculous and never-ending. I'd like to be talking about lacrosse. I really would. This nice spring day. I know it's spring because I had to commit my annual act of genocide. Every year at the same time, in the same place, a whole bunch of these little tiny ants appear in my house. Same ants, well, different ants, obviously, but same place. I can't figure out where they're coming from. They just all of a sudden appear as if, well, this is the place, you know, we're going to be. This is the best place on earth for us to be, right in the middle of this person's living room, where there's nothing for them to feed on, you know, nothing of interest. I can't imagine how fate landed them there, but they never last very long. They last about a day. One day in the spring, I massacre a couple of hundred ants, and that's the end of that. But it's always the same thing. You know, sometimes nature just doesn't get it. Anyway, so the insecticide is all over the place, and all kinds of mayhem going on there. But more mayhem is going on in the rest of the world, probably of a worse sort. And that, of course, centers on the cities of Fallujah, where, oh boy, there's all kinds of outbreaks going on there. Fallujah is supposedly the stronghold, or the last stronghold of Saddam's forces, the Sunnis. And no, they're not affiliated with the State University of New York. I've been asked to make that clear. And there's fighting going on even as we speak. All throughout there. But the United States is still referring to it as a ceasefire, which is rather interesting. A lot of doublespeak and all kinds of words that don't make any sense. Watch the press conferences. They're really funny. And then you have the city of Najaf, where basically you have the radical cleric. Yeah, that guy al-Sadr. He's now he's being alleged or accused of stockpiling weapons in mosques. Now, how do we know this? Because other Iraqis are telling us. Same Iraqis that told us about the weapons of mass destruction. Yeah, these Iraqis are saying, you know, he's doing this and he's putting them there. So go ahead, bomb the mosques. And that's what we're doing. We're bombing mosques now. Isn't that something? It's like every week, you know, we're not going to do this. You know, we wouldn't cross that line. And next week we've crossed that line. And now there's a new line. What are we going to do this week? Well, you know, maybe we won't murder women and children in front of cameras. You know, maybe we keep that line a distance away. But you never know. You never know. Every week it's something new. So those are the two hotspots right now. But expect there to be many more hotspots when attacks happen in these two places, which they will happen. In fact, they're happening now. Despite the ceasefire, there's all kinds of firing happening. I was watching some of the footage before. A lot of people are going to be killed. A lot of people on our side are going to be killed. If you consider the U.S. government side to be our side, I consider the people that are over there to be fellow citizens, people that we know and see in the streets when they're here, and they really shouldn't be over there. And the whole thing has just gotten to be so absurd and stupid. You have to ask yourself, well, okay, now, what happens if we just leave? You know, nobody will say this. Nobody, Kerry will not say this. Certainly Bush will not say this. And I don't think any of the major candidates ever considered just leaving. Not leaving, you know, and telling the people that, oh, you're on your own now. Of course, we'd have to pay all kinds of reparations for what we did to the place. But look at Fallujah, for instance. Okay, there are people there that would like to shoot bullets at our soldiers and fire mortars and all kinds of things like that. That's not friendly, no. But it is their city, it's their country, and what exactly are we doing there? We don't think they have weapons of mass destruction, right? No one said that word in a long time. And it's not likely that they're holding Saddam Hussein because we've got him. Okay, so what's left then? Well, I guess we have to control the country and make sure that they implement a government that is something that we like. Of course, but that was never really the reason we went in there in the first place. We went in there because we were being threatened by something, by a madman who had weapons of mass destruction. Well, there's no more madman, unless we want to create new madmen. And weapons of mass destruction, nobody knows where those are, even if they existed. So the only reason we're staying in there right now is for pride. Not the Hofstra pride, just the American pride. The kind that keeps us from admitting when we've made a big mistake, counting our losses, and trying to maintain some dignity in the world. Imagine how much respect we would get if we just admitted that, you know, this whole thing was a bad idea and we're sorry. Now let's see if we can try and help you guys out and let you rebuild your country on your terms. Yeah, I know there's going to be disagreements. The Sunnis, the Shiites, the Kurds. But you know what? It's their disagreements. They have to iron all that out. We're not the world's policemen. We're not supposed to be, anyway. But, of course, that's not the way it's going to happen, is it? No, what we're doing instead, you catch the latest news? We made them a new flag. We made the Iraqis a brand new flag. It's sort of like making a cake, I guess, you know? Here you go, this is going to be your flag from now on. I looked at this and I was flabbergasted. I was absolutely flabbergasted. Oh yeah, of course, you know, it's the Iraqi Governing Council that did it. But the Iraqi Governing Council was appointed by the United States, not by the Iraqi people. They've got no say in it whatsoever. So you better believe that you know, the tapestries were being woven somewhere in Washington D.C. in one form or another. And you see this thing that they come up with. But first, I want to read you a story. And this might make you sit down and take notice. The Bush administration's audacious plan to rebuild Iraq envisions a sweeping overhaul of Iraqi society within a year of a war's end, but leaves much of the work to private U.S. companies, according to Monday's Wall Street Journal. Central to this new plan includes a new Iraqi flag. The Bush plan, as detailed in more than 100 pages of confidential contract documents, stated that a new flag was needed in order to foster a new sense of national identity and purpose. President Bush was quoted as saying, "This new flag is what the Iraqi people need. I speak of the freedom and prosperity that we hope for their new democratic nation." Sounds like Bush speak, doesn't it? Washington has come under international criticism for failing to broaden the post-war rebuilding effort, even as it continues to do battle with traditional allies over the merits of launching a war on Iraq. In particular, the new flag, with its similarity to the U.S. flag, was criticized as insensitive. In response, President Bush stated, "When I look at our own flag, I'm filled with pride and hope. In time, so the Iraqi people. This war is about bringing people hope, not about American interest or about oil. We plan to rebuild Iraq and provide them with the assistance they need to be a democratic nation. We plan to provide this help as long as it takes." What do you think about that, huh? Okay, confession. That story is not real. That was a fake story, but I'll bet you believed it for a second. It sounded like exactly the kind of thing we would do. And this story was written over a year ago, March 17, 2003. Found it on a website called jameslove.com. who I guess is the guy that wrote it. And he has a picture of the Iraqi flag there, the new Iraqi flag with stars and stripes and things like that. But they have three stars in the middle, like the Iraqi flag that we're all familiar with has. So the story about the new flag, though, that is not a false story. That story I just read you was, in fact, fiction. But the actual thing that has happened now this week kind of follows along those lines. So this is an example of the absurd preceding and then becoming fact. Here's the real story. And this was in the Washington Post. It was supposed to be the perfect symbol for a new and unified Iraq, an Islamic crescent on a field of pure white, with two blue stripes representing the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, and a third yellow stripe to symbolize the country's Kurdish minority. But the new national flag presented on Monday after an artistic competition sponsored by the Iraqi Governing Council appears to have met with widespread public disapproval, in part because of its design and in part because of the increasing unpopularity of the U.S.-appointed council. In interviews in several Baghdad neighborhoods, a variety of residents expressed strong negative reactions to the flag, which was reproduced in most daily newspapers. In particular, people objected to the pale blue color of the crescent and stripes, saying it was identical to the dominant color in the flag of Israel. You know, that's the first thing that I noticed when I looked at this flag, was the color. And yeah, you know, you could say, well, why should you hate it just because it's the same color as Israel? Well, that's not the point. It's one of these, like, you know, little swipes at a country just designed to piss them off and raise up all these ugly feelings. What, you don't like it just because it looks like Israel's flag? What's wrong with you? You know, why have this conversation? The flags of most Arab countries are red, green, and black. If you look at the flags, you'll notice this. And a lot of people were upset that those colors are absent. They're also, if you look at the history of flags, there are all kinds of websites that give you this. You'll see the history of the Iraqi flag. And first of all, the Iraqi flag existed long before Saddam Hussein. They're saying that they're changing the flag because they have to change it due to Saddam Hussein. And that's nonsense because the flag existed for a number of decades before that. There were different flags before that as well in the 20s and at the turn of the century. But the flag with the three stars in the middle and the red, green, and black, that was Iraq's flag for most of the century. Now, in 1991... an Islamic phrase, lettering, was added that says, God is great. So that's the writing that you see on the Iraqi flag. Or it's either God is great or God is greatest. Which is it? I don't know. God's pretty good, okay? Whatever. It says something like that. This new flag was just kind of thrown out as a surprise. And It's got to be one of the dumbest things that I think the coalition, and I'm putting that in quotes and italicizing it, could have done. Because what better way to get people to really hate you than to change the flag of your country, for foreigners to come in and change your flag and tell you what you should be symbolizing and give you the colors and all that? It's about as dumb as you can get. It's about as dumb as bombing mosques, I guess. Here's Al Jazeera's perspective on it. Iraq's governing council has adopted a new national flag to replace the one flown by Saddam Hussein, with emblems to represent peace, Islam, and Iraq's Kurdish population. It's funny, that paragraph seems a whole lot more friendly to the flag than Washington Post. Yeah, Al Jazeera, those terrorist journalists, the ones that are friends with Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein, the evil people. Yeah, you've heard about them on Fox, haven't you? Go to english.aljazeera.net. You might be surprised. It's A-L-J-A-Z-E-E-R-A. Continuing here, the new flag consists of a pale blue crescent on a white background and has a yellow strip between two lines of blue at the bottom. It will be raised over government buildings within days, according to Hamid Al-Kafai, a spokesman. The white stands for peace and a new start for Iraq, whilst the crescent represents Islam. He said, adding the blue strips represented Iraq's main rivers, as we mentioned, and the yellow represents its Kurdish population. How come they get a strip? You know, the Sunnis don't get a strip, and the Shiites, I don't know. I'd like to know what the Kurds think about being a yellow strip on a flag. Does that represent your culture in an acceptable way? Anyway, the old flag, red, white, and black, with three green stars representing pan-Arab nationalism, had flown for more than 40 years, preceding Saddam Hussein, who was ousted by U.S.-led occupation forces just over a year ago. And during the 1980s Iran-Iraq War, Saddam Hussein added the Arabic words, "God is great," to the flag. That's a mistake, I think. I'm pretty sure that was added in 1991, right before the Gulf War. I don't know, Al Jazeera, you might have gotten that fact wrong, or I might be wrong. We'll figure this out. But not everyone is happy with the decision, with one council member saying that Iraq's leaders should wait for an elected government before changing the flag. Gee whiz, what a radical idea. That person says, I think there are issues more important to concentrate on now than changing the flag. Iraq's Al-Sabah newspaper, which published the design in its print edition, said that the designer's name was Rifat Al-Shadirchi and that his design had been chosen out of more than 30 proposals. Unbelievable. And the Associated Press reports that the new design abandons the symbols of Saddam's regime. It also avoids the colors used in other Arab flags, green and black for Islam and red for Arab nationalism. The change recalls the U.S. agenda of creating a new Iraq that is exceptional in the Arab world. Now, of course, the only country in the Middle East with blue stripes, similar to this, is Israel, which has a Star of David on a field of white between horizontal blue bands. Council spokesman Hamid Al-Kafai said the designer was asked to touch up the color of the crescent, perhaps to a darker blue or a different color. The final version will be announced later this week. I think that's new, actually. I think they realized that, you know what, this isn't going to work. Let's make another version. So, yeah, new flags. Anyway, speaking of stupidity, though, something really incredibly stupid. I find very hard to believe. A militant group has threatened to kill three Italian hostages unless their countrymen demonstrate against the presence of Italian troops in Iraq. And that's according to a video aired on an Arabic news channel. So let me get this straight. They take hostages. They take these three Italian hostages and they say, okay, world, we're going to kill these three people unless the Italian public turns out and demonstrates against the occupation. What better way to make people not demonstrate against the occupation? I mean, these people are either incredibly stupid or they're on a different side. Because if anything is going to unite the Italian people and get them to support the stupid actions that their government has taken in this, it's this kind of an action. It's this kind of threatening and bullying. These guys must be new at the art of hostage taking, because that's not what you do. Al Arabiya said a group calling itself the Green Brigade released the video of three men sitting around a table eating. It said these are the remaining three Italian hostages. A fourth hostage taken with the others on April 12th was executed. In a written statement the group released with the tape, it demanded Italian citizens organized demonstrations against the presence of Italian troops in Iraq. The group gave Italians 5 days to organize demonstrations. Otherwise, the statement said the hostages would be killed. Can you imagine trying to organize a demonstration with that kind of a threat? Nobody's going to respect you. No one's going to say you're doing the right thing. It's insane. I can't figure this one out at all. I really can't. I also have to wonder, though, what constitutes a demonstration? Like, can I call a friend and say, hey, let's demonstrate, and two of us stand in the street holding a sign, and hey, you know, if we're Italians and we organize a demonstration within 5 days, that counts, right? You got to release the guys. I mean, you know, it's stupidly phrased as well as being a stupid idea to start with. Not to mention the whole stupid idea of taking hostages, but we won't even get into that. So, yeah, it's mayhem over there. The Spanish troops are leaving as of today, I believe, and they're being replaced by British troops. So that should be fun as well. And June 30th is that magical date that's coming up in the future. That's where we hand over power. But it's not going to happen exactly the way you probably thought it was going to happen. Although listeners to this program probably didn't think it was going to happen at all. The United States has warned that the new government due to take power in Iraq on actually July 1st, the day after June 30th, will have to delegate some of its powers to the coalition, meaning the United States. Secretary of State Colin Powell said it was important that the coalition troops continued to operate under U.S. command. His comments came after a day of heavy fighting in Fallujah, where U.S. soldiers and Iraqi security forces had been due to begin joint patrols on Tuesday, and that did not happen. Speaking in Washington, Mr. Powell said that the coalition did not mean to seize anything away from the planned caretaker government. It is with the understanding that they need our help, and for us to provide that help, we have to be able to operate freely, which in some ways infringes on what some would call full sovereignty. But in an interview with the Associated Press, the current head of the U.S.-backed Iraqi Governing Council, Masoud Barzani, accused the U.S. of behaving like an army of occupation. These are the guys we appointed accusing us of this now. If it were me, I wouldn't have allowed it to come to this by making earlier mistakes, he said. I probably wouldn't have made the mistake of letting an army of liberation turn into an army of occupation. The BBC's State Department correspondent, John Lane, says there is a danger that the new Iraqi government will be seen as a puppet of the American occupiers. But Mr. Powell insisted that the coalition wanted the new government to have a real part to play in rebuilding Iraq. From day one on, I hope that they will exercise more and more control over the ministries, over the priorities for reconstruction, over answering questions of their people. It is in our interest to have that happen. I'd love to know what people think. You can write to us, otw@2600.com.
Well,
we have an abbreviated show today because of the upcoming lacrosse game. So I'm not sure if we have time for calls, but we certainly welcome your email, and we will be able to take calls in subsequent weeks.
In simple speech, my common language.
And over the on the other side of the ocean, things aren't very happy for Tony Blair either. More than 50 former British diplomats have blasted Tony Blair, saying the Prime Minister must either influence America's doomed policy in the Middle East or stop backing it. This comes from Al Jazeera. In an unprecedented letter published on Monday by 52 former ambassadors, high commissioners, and governors, the top ranks of British diplomacy, Blair was urged to sway U.S. policy in the region as a matter of the highest urgency. The diplomats, among them former ambassadors to Iraq and Israel, told Blair they had watched with deepening concern the policies which you have followed on the Arab-Israel problem and Iraq in close cooperation with the United States. We feel the time has come to make our anxieties public in the hope that they will be addressed in Parliament and will lead to a fundamental reassessment. The spokesman would not be drawn into how Blair would respond to the attack, which the diplomats believe is unprecedented in scope and scale. The Prime Minister rejects the idea that there is, in some sense, a scorecard between British objectives and U.S. objectives, the aide said to reporters. Britain's objective is a democracy in Iraq, a two-state solution in the Middle East. Those are objectives that Britain will work with our allies, including the U.S., to achieve. The protest letter comes as Blair faces deep discontent among voters for backing a U.S.-led war that most Britons had opposed and for endorsing a Washington-driven policy that has put London on a collision course with allies in Europe. It's unbelievable. I don't know if this was reported in the American press very much. But it was pretty strongly opposed to the things that are going on over there. The diplomats criticized the toll of the war and apparent lack of a plan for life in the country post-Saddam. The Iraqis killed by coalition forces probably totaled between 10,000 and 15,000, they said. There was no effective plan for the post-Saddam settlement. To describe the resistance as led by terrorists, fanatics, and foreigners is neither convincing nor helpful. You have to listen to these guys. They know of what they speak. And on the Palestinian question, the diplomats said big powers had waited for U.S. leadership to advance a roadmap for peace that had raised expectations of a lasting Israeli-Palestinian settlement. The hopes were ill-founded. Nothing effective has been done, either to move the negotiations forward or to curb the violence. Britain and the other sponsors of the roadmap merely waited on American leadership, but waited in vain, it said. Worse was to come, they continued, attacking Bush's decision this month to endorse an Israeli plan to retain some settlements in the West Bank as an illegal and one-sided step. Our dismay at this backward step is heightened by the fact that you yourself seem to have endorsed it, abandoning the principles which for nearly four decades have guided international efforts to restore peace in the Holy Land. Blair has backed Bush in public, but privately, government sources fear the so-called roadmap is in tatters. The Prime Minister has also attacked Israel's assassination of two Hamas leaders, in sharp contrast to Washington. Now, what do you think of that, huh? Washington basically saying nothing about that. Ariel Sharon is out of control. I mean, he's basically saying, you know what, I'm going to kill Arafat now. I don't care. I made an agreement not to do it, but I'm just going to kill him. I mean, it's insanity. Insanity has happened. We are living under it now. I've noticed a kind of a theme in mass culture lately. It's important to sort of pay attention to these things. I don't mean, you know, reality shows. I'll never stoop that low. But, you know, basically, things that are happening in the entertainment world. TV shows, for instance. A couple of weeks ago on the TV show 24... And if anybody hasn't seen this show, you better turn the thing off, because if you're planning on being surprised, you're not going to be surprised once I tell you what happens. The main character, Jack Bauer, is faced with a horrible decision he has to make. Actually, no, he's not the one that has to make the decision. The President of the United States, President Palmer, has to make the decision when faced with a terrorist threat to unleash a biological germ or disease or something, a virus, yeah, which has already been released in a hotel. But it'll be released in a lot more places unless you do what I say. And one of the demands is to kill a particular federal agent. And Jack Bauer, being another federal agent, is given the happy task of carrying that out. Of course, they try to find the guy that that made the threat and keep that from happening. But in the end, he has to put a gun to the guy that he works with and pull the trigger and kill him right there to carry through with that demand. It's the wrong thing to do, but for the right reasons. It's for the greater good. To callously kill somebody in cold blood right there. And then on Enterprise, the Star Trek show, last week, the captain stole an engine or a warp drive or something from this innocent race of people that was just out there exploring, because it was the only way that he could move his ship forward to get a hold of the Zindi weapon or whatever. Again, the wrong thing to do for the right reasons. He may have doomed these people to starvation or death or just being stranded in the middle of nowhere. And now you got Ariel Sharon, who probably watches these programs saying, yeah, I know murder's wrong. I'm good at it, though. It's one of my few talents. And it's probably going to earn me some condemnation, but it's for the right reason. Wrong thing to do, but it's for the right reason. So don't be an enemy of Ariel Sharon, or he'll send a rocket your way. It's crazy. It's absolutely insane. And we just sit back and watch it happen. At some point, you have to slap somebody across the face. Yeah, I wish somebody would slap Ariel Sharon across the face. I really do. Actually, I wish for a lot more for him. But but come on already. He needs a slap. He really does. To be knocked back into this dimension where you can't just do whatever you want because you're a big bully. Yeah, I know. There are people doing bad things out there. But you can't punish them before they do it. You can't punish people that you think are going to do things. This isn't science fiction. This is reality. If you believe all Palestinians are bad, if you believe everybody affiliated with Hamas is a terrorist, then I guess you can justify it in your head. But it's not really that simple. It's not really that clear cut. Because a lot of people say the same thing about the other side as well. And anybody with half a brain would condemn those kinds of things. People who blow up buses are scum. There's no question about that. It's a horrible thing to do, to terrorize people. But you know what? So are people that send missiles into crowds of people to kill one guy in a wheelchair, you know, because he's somehow a threat. Those people are scum too. Anyone who terrorizes people, anyone who rules by force, they are scum. They need to be removed, whatever means possible. And I'd like to say that most people of the world, I think, stand in solidarity with each other for such things as peace and freedom and self-determination. I mean, that's really what it's all about, isn't it? That's what these themes keep coming back to. So it's kind of a simple equation if you just think about it a little bit. Ask yourself, am I promoting peace? Am I allowing people to self-determine their futures? Am I using force to make my point? If you sit back and try to get away from all the rhetoric, you might be surprised by what side you're actually on. The side of good or bad, or just confused. All right, North Korea. Boy, that was fun, wasn't it? I guess, you know, the lesson to be learned from North Korea is not a good idea to transport dynamite on freight trains that go through populated areas. I'm not quite sure how you transport dynamite. I've never had to do it. But that just doesn't seem like the way, you know? Maybe you should just make the dynamite in the place that you need it. You notice how most of the problems of the world are involved with things being transported from one place to another? You know, that's what causes all the problems. That's what causes wars and starvation. And even computers. That's a big problem with computers. Transporting data from one computer to another, that's always where the issues arise. If everything could just be in one place, you know, we wouldn't have these problems. So have the dynamite where you need it. Simple solution there. But watching how this story unfolded was fascinating. The people who reported it first were the South Koreans. They love reporting disasters in North Korea. But did you see how it was reported? They made it sound like it was a complete apocalypse. Over 3,000 people killed. And, of course, we just reported that blindly without even asking the question, well, how could 3,000 people die when a train car explodes? I mean, that's one crowded train, or it's one crowded train station. But, you know, all the pictures of the train station from the past looked like it was in the middle of the country, and there really weren't that many people around. So how exactly could so many have died? Then later I saw there were pictures of apartment buildings that were nearby. So if those had been flattened, okay, I could see a lot of people dying. But 3,000? And now the number is, I think, 161. We just sort of adjusted the figures. Now, North Korea was no help here because they didn't really report anything. But it's weird how they do things up there. They, I guess they don't say a word until they know what they're talking about or know how they want to say it and manipulate it. So while they were scrambling around trying to find everybody and see what the situation was, they basically maintained radio silence. And that's to their own people as well. People in Pyongyang to the south had no idea what was going on, or even that anything had happened. A lot of the news is coming out of China and, of course, South Korea. And I've been watching the offers of help that have been given to them, and I'm amazed at how small they are. The United States today said, okay, we're going to give you $100,000. You know, and saying that it doesn't matter that you're evil people and all that kind of thing. We're still going to help you. $100,000? I mean, I know people that can give that kind of money. An entire country giving $100,000? That's it? China, $1 million. I mean, yeah, okay, $1 million is a lot of money to a person, but to another country that has suffered a horrible disaster, it's not really that much. So that's what's going on over there. Hopefully they'll emerge from this with a little bit of, I guess, more contact with other people, other countries. North Korea is the weirdest place in the world. It's kind of like a big religious cult, according to descriptions that I've heard, which makes it really fascinating, you know? Anyway, we'll try to get more information out of there. We'll try to make phone calls to North Korea, as we always do. All right, well, let's see, we kind of have to wrap things up because there's a lacrosse game coming in about 12 minutes. And, you know, something's going on this campus because when I was driving over here, boy, oh, maybe I shouldn't be saying this, but there's university police everywhere. I never saw so many of them. coming in, there was one car there by the north entrance, and then I passed another one, and then there was one waiting by the side of the road on the way up Infirmary Drive, which is now called Stadium Drive, because our priorities have changed. And then here in the parking lot, there were another three cars, and they were all looking at me. So I don't know. I don't know how much concern this radio program causes, but there's activity out there. There's a lot of activity. All right. You here for lacrosse? Good. The sports department has arrived, and the game will begin, I guess, at 7 o'clock, right? Good, okay. Well, lacrosse is a weird game. It really is. I don't know why it never actually took off in the majors. I discovered this. I was looking up some history of lacrosse before. There is a National Lacrosse League. I remember when I was a kid there was a National Lacrosse League. Does anybody remember the name of the team that we had? Sports guy, remember the name of the team?
Well, they have the Saints.
The New York Saints. That's very good. That was last year's team, but they're out of business, right?
Yes, yeah. But now. They may come back next year.
But did you know there was another National Lacrosse League before this one? And we had a team on Long Island. Do you remember what they were called?
No.
Oh, okay. See, I know something about sport that the sports people don't know. Yes, back in 1975, the Long Island Tomahawks.
Wow.
Check it out.
Where'd they play?
They played in, where did they play? Nassau Coliseum? I think they played Nassau Coliseum.
Wow.
Yeah. Only 1 year, though. And they won the division. They didn't win the championship. A bunch of Canadians won that. They had transferred the year before. They were a team in Rochester before that. But yeah, lacrosse, okay, I'm going to go into the history of lacrosse a little bit here. It was one of many varieties of indigenous stickball games that were being played by American Indians at the time of European contact, but it goes back a lot further than that. Almost exclusively a male team sport, it's distinguished from the others, such as field hockey or shinny. Shinny. When's the last time you had a good game of shinny? By the use of a netted racket with which to pick the ball off the ground, throw, catch, and convey it into or past a goal to score a point. The cardinal rule in all varieties of lacrosse was that the ball, with few exceptions, must not be touched with the hands. I love those sports where you don't touch things with your hands. Early data on lacrosse from missionaries such as French Jesuits in Huron Country in the 1630s, wow, and English explorers such as Jonathan Carver in the mid-18th century in the Great Lakes area are scant and often conflicting. They inform us mostly about team size, equipment used, the duration of games, and length of playing fields, but tell us almost nothing about stick handling, game strategy, or the rules of play, not to mention the standings and the playoffs. The oldest surviving sticks date only from the first quarter of the 19th century, and the first detailed reports on Indian lacrosse are even later. Lacrosse was given its name by early French settlers, using the generic term for any game played with a curved stick, known as cross, and a ball. Native terminology, however, tends to describe more the technique of men hitting a rounded object, or especially in the Southeast, to underscore the game's aspects of war surrogacy. It's known as the Little Brother of War. There is no evidence of non-Indians taking up the game until the mid-19th century, when English-speaking Montrealers adopted the Mohawk game they were familiar with from two tribes I am not going to try to pronounce. Attempting to civilize, in quotes, the sport with a new set of rules and organize into amateur clubs. Once the game quickly grew in popularity in Canada, it began to be exported throughout the Commonwealth as non-native teams traveled to Europe for exhibition matches against Iroquois players. And ironically, because Indians had to charge money in order to travel, they were excluded as professionals from international competition for more than a century. Only with the formation of the Iroquois Nationals in the 1980s did they successfully break this barrier and become eligible to compete in world games. Apart from its recreational function, lacrosse traditionally played a more serious role in Indian culture. Its origins are rooted in legend, and the game continues to be used for curative purposes and surrounded with ceremony. No doubt you'll be seeing some of that ceremony tonight at Stony Brook. I hope, anyway. Game equipment and players are still ritually prepared by conjurers. Well, we have a conjurer here. Gets paid a pretty salary. At team selection and victory are often considered supernaturally controlled. In the past, lacrosse also served to vent aggression. In the past? Yeah. And territorial disputes between tribes were sometimes settled with a game, although not always amicably. A Creek versus Choctaw game around 1790 to determine rights over a beaver pond broke out into a violent battle when the Creeks were declared winners. Still, while the majority of the games ended peaceably, much of the ceremonialism surrounding their preparations and the rituals required of the players were identical to those practiced before departing on the warpath. Anyway, a number of factors led to the demise of lacrosse in many areas by the late 19th century. Wagering on games had also been a major part of the Indian community's involvement. But when betting and violence saw an increase as traditional Indian culture was eroding, it sparked opposition to lacrosse from government officials and missionaries. The games were felt to interfere with church attendance, and the wagering had an impoverishing effect on the Indians. When Oklahoma Choctaw began to attach lead weights to their sticks around 1900 to use them as skullcrackers, the game was banned. I don't know if we'll have skullcrackers tonight, but... Meanwhile, the spread of non-native lacrosse from the Montreal area eventually led to its position today worldwide as one of the fastest-growing sports, more than 500,000 players. Controlled by official regulations and played with manufactured rather than handmade equipment. And this is an interesting quotation from 1718, referring to people playing the game. In summer, they play a great deal at lacrosse, 20 or more on each side. Their bat is a sort of small racket, and the ball with which they play is a very heavy wood, a little larger than the balls we use in tennis. When they play, they are entirely naked. they have only a breech clout and shoes of deer skin. I sense interest has gone up quite a bit. Their bodies are painted all over with all kinds of colors. There are some who paint their bodies with white clay, applying it to resembles silver lace sewed on all the seams of a coat, and at a distance one would take for silver lace. Aboriginal tribes across the North American continent avidly played lacrosse as a form of recreation, as training for the art of war. Rules of the game differed from tribe to tribe. Various different lengths of sticks, some were 3 feet long. Some tribes drilled holes in to produce whistling sounds when the balls were thrown. Pretty amazing. Here's a description of a game. From the 1600s. At the appointed time, they gather in a crowd in the center of the field, and one of the two captains, having the ball in his hand, tosses it up in the air, each player trying to send it in the proper direction. If the ball falls to the ground, they try to pull it towards themselves with their bats, and should it fall outside the crowd of players, the most active of them win distinction by following closely after it. They make a great noise, striking one against another when they try to parry strokes in order to drive the ball in the proper direction. If a player keeps the ball between his feet and is unwilling to let it go, he must guard against the blows his adversaries continually aim at his feet. If he happens to be wounded, it is his own fault. Legs and arms are sometimes broken, and it has happened that a player has been killed. Boy, it is quite common to see someone crippled for the rest of his life who would not have had this misfortune but for his own obstinacy. I hope the players aren't listening to this right now. I'd be getting a little nervous. When these accidents happen, the unlucky victim quickly withdraws from the game, unless, of course, he's killed. If he is in a condition to do so, but if his injury will not permit this, his relatives carry him home, and the game goes on until it is finished as if nothing had occurred. So it's, lacrosse is a serious business here. And, you know, sometimes, looking over some more of the history here, sometimes the game actually would last for days. Yeah. Often teams were made up of 100 to 1,000 people on each side. I don't think our stadium can hold that. The goals were usually 500 yards to a half mile apart. On occasion, the goals could be separated by several miles. That's it makes it a whole lot more challenging, I think. Games lasted from sunup to sundown and stretched over the course of 2 or 3 days. Lacrosse games were originally used to toughen graves for actual combat. All right, enough of a lead-in here. It's quite a rough sport. This game probably won't last all day, and it probably won't go for miles, and I don't think there'll be 1,000 people on our side, but...
We didn't do.
It ought to be pretty good all the same. So, are we ready to go? Okay, I'm trying to get the CD player to work so I can start this thing here. Manuel Goldstein, have yourselves a good night. Stay tuned for lacrosse, where we're going to kick the ass of the pride over there in Hofstra. And we'll see you again next week.
sucked again. Looking for salvation, we had an ice cream stutter. I said, have you ever wondered what became of Uncle Bill? We were peeling potatoes back in World War II. And we was playing that rock and roll at the school for you-know-who. Hidden from the public, it was behind the scenes. There was a relic they called the purple hair. I was eating a taco, I looked across the room. I saw a girl in a red dress, she said she'd like to see me in. I left the waiter a tip, I scrambled for the door. I said you might have loved me, but now there's nothing more. She's always on my trail, she really likes to kill. I keep a lovely picture on my windowsill. I was just a cowboy without a show. I was like the kind of guy you never really know. You won't forget me, no matter how hard you try. And when it's my time to go, I'll wave goodbye. Sing yourself a melody, quiet fear of joy.
The great light, shedding rays of divine love. Let the light pour into you.